Good evening, and welcome to Art World Innovators, exploring stories of innovation in the art world. I'm your host, Susan Cohn, and you're listening to UMFM 101.5 at the University of Manitoba. Our guest this evening is Canadian painter Julie Bugin. Grew up in Calgary and is now living in Berlin. Julie completed her BFA at Emily Carr University in 2004 and her Master's in Fine Arts at Concordia University in 2008. Her MFA thesis exhibition was at Optica Center of Contemporary Art in Montreal. She's had works in numerous solo and group exhibitions across Canada and Berlin. She was shortlisted for the RBC painting competition in 2009 and has been the recipient of grants from the British Columbia Arts Council and the Canada Council for the Arts. Julie's works are held in private and public collections such as the National Museum of Fine Arts in Quebec. Welcome to Art World Innovators, and thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
From reading various writings about your work, you've suggested that in your early paintings, you combined landscapes with interiors, placing the viewer simultaneously inside and outside, that spaces suggest narratives, and your paintings have been inspired by your passion for literature. Can you elaborate on how your combination of literature and various spaces may have inspired your dynamic and vibrant 2008 paintings, Gardens of the Most Unlimited Freedom and Wildflowers and Dark Fins Pressed Against the Paper in the collection of the National Museum of Fine Arts in Quebec? And can you describe these pieces for our audience?
Ooh, we're going back. So those were around 2008, almost 10 years ago. And I was really interested in this combining the spaces described in literature and the details with my own memories or daily life or something that I encounter in my everyday life. And that mixture of imagination and reality is the space of reading, this kind of what you visualize when you read, and I was interested in how that happened and how to make that visual and translate it into painting. So those two paintings, one is half of a plumbing store with waterfalls. And they're these kind of fantastical, almost hallucinatory paintings that are this mixture between landscape and interior, gives you again this feeling of imagination, of half real, half dreamlike almost.
They definitely do. Looking at them, they bring things together that are just so unique. When you moved to Berlin, your focus shifted and you discovered new ideas as you explored a new landscape and a cultural history. Can you tell us how your style and process of creating your works changed in response to your new landscape and experiences?
It's been a slow shift, but the biggest difference was moving to a big city and a totally different art historical context. The landscape painting that is so present in Canadian art suddenly didn't make a lot of sense within the context of Berlin and living in this big, big, bustling city. And so I shifted away slowly from the landscape references and more towards the city. And just as a response to what I was encountering in a daily life, both in the museums and the art here, as well as just living in the big city.
How does your process change? Are you still using photography? Are you still using collages? How are you bringing your works together?
So now I'm painting, it's almost completely abstract, although it still has a suggestion of space. And I shifted from, at the beginning of my time in Berlin, around 2010, I was using found photos of magazine photos and that kind of thing. And I began to feel like there was too many restrictions with those photos, that kind of these set photos you find in magazines are composed in similar ways and have similar angles. And you end up working with these restrictions, somebody else's visual choices. So I started moving towards my own photos. Now I still work. I use a guideline of my own photographs as just to determine the structure and shape of my abstract gestures now. And that's just a way to start something.
Can you tell us a bit about the book, One Arm in Each Sleeve, Collages, that you wrote?
It's a book of my photographic collage. So it's an artist book that I made to accompany my last exhibition in Toronto at Paul Petro last spring. And it was the first time that I showed my digital collages of urban space to the world. So usually they're just kind of a secret part of my painting process. It's a collection of, I think, about 15 of the collages that are kind of these curved shapes of the city that take these little corners of shadows or light or bits of architecture and I kind of make them into organic combinations. So perspectives are matched, different perspectives come together, and you again get this kind of mixture of real space but turned kind of imaginary and strange.
And you mentioned you have an exhibit at that time with a gallery there. Can you tell us what that experience has been like and how that's helped you in your career?
In terms of showing at galleries?
Yeah, showing and being able to have somebody represent you. And
yeah, I mean, it's been huge. I'm now represented by two galleries, Paul Petro in Toronto and Vivian Art in Calgary. So I'll have a show coming up with Vivian next spring, in spring 2019. Yeah, it's been great to, even while I live in Berlin, to have that connection to Canada and to show regularly. And over the past 3 to 4 years, I've been having a solo show every year and alternating between Calgary and Toronto. And it's been, yeah, a real push, an incentive to make a finished show that has a cohesive idea. And also, you always learn from hanging an exhibition and seeing what it looks like in a space and getting the feedback, and all that stuff is a huge part of moving on to the next step in my process.
Do you have to accommodate a certain line of art in order to be able to exhibit, or it's just part of the process?
They're commercial galleries both, but they're both very open to the changes that my work has gone through over the years. And yeah, I've just had one show with Vivian, but I've been showing with Paul since I graduated from my MFA. And he's been very supportive of all the various shifts I've had from representational painting to quite abstract painting now.
That's great. It must be very encouraging for you. And next to London and New York, Berlin is, you know, a major art center. Can you tell us what it's been like being in the art scene there and having the opportunities to go to the museums, and what sort of experience you may have had with people that you can exchange ideas with while you're there?
Oh, it's been a huge part of living in Berlin for sure, and it's one of the reasons I'm still living here. It's so dynamic and so international. So you not only see exhibitions from all over the world, but you meet people from all over the world. And it's been huge for the development, just to understand your practice within such a wide and diverse context. When we first moved to Berlin, we had a critique group, which was very international. So we would meet every couple of months in different people's studios, and it was so interesting getting the feedback of young people who had all been educated in different countries, and you kind of see the biases of your own education and what you learned. And yeah, it's been very stimulating and continues to be exciting here.
So would you recommend younger artists, as part of their artistic journey and their education, visit Berlin? And what other advice might you share?
Yeah, I would recommend to anyone just to travel in general. I think Berlin is not, of course, the only place to go. I'm sure. I think travel can just widen any artist's vision. Berlin now has changed a lot since I've come, and it's become more expensive than it used to be. So I'm not sure if it'll change to be less of a hub for young artists, because it used to be so easy to find studio space and apartments and all that kind of thing. And it's starting to be a little more difficult now. So, yeah.
Has it shifted any as far as being such a strong center in comparison to London and New York, or do you still see it as a thriving art center?
Yeah, it is a thriving art center, but I think there's less money than in London and New York. So I think the commercial gallery scene, a lot of the smaller and mid-sized galleries don't stay open for more than a couple years, or they close. There's a lot of turnover. And I think artists who show here, the sales apparently aren't as high as in London and New York. I think Berlin is still a financially struggling center. But at the same time, I think that has historically opened a lot of opportunities for more experimental work. And there's still a thriving project space scene here, where people run nonprofit spaces that are artists run and quite open to exhibiting young people. And I think that an experimental non-commercial work, which adds a real vibrancy to the scene, which is maybe less possible in a place like London or New York, where the real estate has become unaffordable. So these kind of project spaces are less possible, or less dynamic, maybe. I don't know. I haven't lived in New York. and or well, London. I lived shortly as an exchange student in my undergrad, but I don't really know the scenes in either of those cities.
Yeah, and does the language pose any problems, or do you speak German?
My German, it's a constant project. It's a difficult language, but I'm working on it. But the art world often functions in English, it's such an international scene that English goes a long way.
Well, that's good. And yeah, I imagine in those critique groups, being from so many different countries, it wasn't as, you know, English would still be the common language.
Yeah, English is still the common language, yeah.
And are there any other particular styles of painting that you have found more successful that you're drawing on to move forward and go into, you know, perhaps another series of works?
Yeah, I mean, I think painting always responds to what has come before. So I'm constantly looking at work, and I think the historical work becomes more interesting to me to find the roots of how things have developed in the past. It changes as I change my practice or what I'm currently interested in. I've been, because I'm making abstract paintings, I'm interested in this gestural mark. Of course, I've looked at a lot of abstract expressionism. And lately I've been thinking more about de Kooning's late works, actually, when he really began to paint really sparsely and had all this white space. And my current works have all these white areas. And I've been, yeah, just interested in how he has these subtle colored fogs, even in his white areas, and how he uses color. And I guess that's kind of what I'm currently struggling with in the studio, is how to maybe shift from these white spaces or tint them or change my colors. Anyways, that's my current preoccupation.
Well, I would like to thank you very much for speaking with us today and taking the time to share your insight and story. It's been a pleasure having you on our show.
Great. Thank you.
That was Julie Bugin, Canadian painter, speaking with us from Berlin. For those of you just tuning in, you are listening to Art World Innovators on UMFM 101.5. This evening we are visiting the studio of artist-in-residence Reva Stone here at the University of Manitoba's School of Art. Reva Stone's work is concerned with an examination of the mediation between our bodies and the technologies that are altering how we interact with the world. She engages with a variety of forms of digital technologies to initiate discourses about how biotechnological and robotic practices are impacting upon the very nature of being human. Her earlier works include pieces such as Imaginal Expression, An Endlessly Mutating Responsive 3D Environment, Carnivale 3.0, An Autonomous Robot That Reflects on the Nature of Human Consciousness, Portal, iPhone, a more recent work that combines custom software, media, robotics, and mobile phone technology to create a work that appears to be sentient. Recently, she has been developing a series of works that critique how drone technologies are being integrated into society, titled Fragments. Reva has received many awards, including the 2017 Distinguished Alumni Award from the University of Manitoba, the 2015 Governor General's Award in Visual and Media Arts, and an honorable mention from Life 5.0 Art and Artificial Life International Competition, Fundación Telefónica, Madrid, Spain. She has shown her works in solo and group exhibitions in Canada, the U.S., and Europe. She has presented at symposia and has been published in journals such as Second Nature, the International Journal of Creative Media. Thank you for inviting me to your studio for this episode of Art World Innovators. It's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, thank you.
Can you describe for us a few of your current innovative pieces?
How I approach my artwork. Most of my work is from something I've observed or seen or read about that I can see is going to make a big impact about how we live in the world. And I always do actually a lot of research about it. So at one time I was looking at medical imaging technology and how the human body was being reduced to smaller and smaller fragments so that you hardly even recognize that it came from a human being. And I actually did a residency with a radiologist in Ottawa, and I looked at all the imaging technology as part of my research, and was given some materials that were taken, and she would take off the patient's name. She was a woman doctor. And then I decided I would try and make some work from this, you know. So I didn't end up doing it because a lot of it was images of the heart and putting in a stent and then the blood flowing, and the blockage was gone, and they were really difficult to make into art. The next thing I was doing was looking at protein molecules, because they were doing the genome sequencing, and that also was something that was reducing to a smaller and smaller and smaller object. And so I ended up making 3D models of protein molecules and introducing the human being back in by scanning my own body. So the wrapping around the 3D molecules was skin, teeth, hair. I worked with a programmer, and we made an interactive 3D world.
Was there a particular incident that led to your decision to include interactive components in your work?
There was a specific time. I was working on a large installation that had a lot to do with children and video games. It was early on, and video games were just the freshest new thing at the time. And I was looking at the gender bias in the games that I was seeing. And I started then looking at children's toys and the gender bias there, which still exists. And I was painting Captain Culture on a great big 6-foot wall, and I was doing other things like that. And Agnetha Dick's son, Richard, said to me, "Have you ever thought about using a computer?" And this was, I think, 1989. So I started thinking about it, and I thought it would be very interesting to use the computer as the material to critique the technology. And so I started investigating that and ended up getting 2 grants because of the idea I had to make this whole work interactive. And I ended up getting a Macintosh 2CX, which was very expensive, and a monitor. And it all came to my studio, and I stood there because I didn't even know how to turn it on. But if you get a really good idea, you push it and you learn how to do it. And that was the beginning of the whole thing for me. And I found that I loved being in that position about not knowing what I was doing. And I had to learn a great deal to be able to do it. And I had to actually rely on other people, because I always needed 3 or 4 or 5 different skill sets, of which maybe for every piece I worked on or I am working on, I had maybe 2 or 3 of them. So I would have to find people I could hire to work with me.
Your works are very ambitious, and you're dealing with technologies which advance at phenomenal rates. And as you've mentioned, you thrive on learning about the things you don't understand and how it is really critical for you to be in way over your head, not knowing how to do what you want to do. Can you tell us a little about your early and recent experimentation and what you've discovered to form your knowledge base that leads to your ideas and the technology that you yourself have developed to create your complex works?
I haven't necessarily myself developed. I've worked with programmers a lot. At the beginning, we had to invent the wheel. We had to code for machine visioning, for a camera being able to act as a sensor to recognize a human being. And I got to be honest, you know, things have slowed down for me to see. There are just so many things that are technological are version 1, version 2, version 3. When a smartphone first came out, I just really knew that that was a technology that was going to really, really have a huge impact. And so I made the cell phone piece that has each one has a separate personality, and they react to the person in the space, and they ask them questions and continues through a flow of conversation. But that was a piece that I made with Nokia phones, because they were the first smartphones, and they were very expensive, and the Nokia software was very buggy, and it was really, really a difficult piece. And it never, even though it was worked on about 2.5 years, when it actually got up and started running, and it was running for more than 30 minutes at a time, I realized that it couldn't handle the video, the changing of the video, and the video got smaller and smaller and smaller every time a video came on the screen. Sometimes there's problems with wanting to use the latest technology or experimenting with it. And that piece probably was one of my first that I really couldn't do, and it was really a problem. But since that time, it's been changed over and rewritten just recently, and it's now an iPhone piece. I've never shown it, but it's on an iPhone, and having an iPhone, you know, and doing it about 8 years later, it's a very responsive piece. It'll track you around the room. There's a motor above, and it hangs down on this pole, and it hangs at eye level. And so it senses you, it turns. If you touch it, it'll say things like, "Get your mitts off my bits." It's actually quite a funny piece. And I have 17 personalities, people who volunteered at the Bounce Center to be the personalities of my phone. So you never know, you know, what's going to happen. But it's actually quite funny, and I thought it would really date. And when I turned it on, it was a different piece than the piece A. And it was almost like you were surrounded and inside social media. So I'm really happy I followed through and redid it, because I really, really like it as a piece. I've never shown it yet, but I'm sure I will.
Oh, that would be exciting to see. Carmen Valley is an intriguing piece, a life-sized aluminum figure placed on a robotic platform that used heat sensors to locate and photograph individuals in the gallery space when you originally exhibited at the WEG. The images were captured, stored, and mimic the way the human memory operates. Can you tell us more about the work and where this idea originated?
Well, at the time, there was a lot of talking about downloading your consciousness into a computer or uploading your consciousness, and that the future of human evolution, I was reading a lot of social theory and stuff like that too, the future of human evolution was going to be to leave our messy bodies behind and get rid of the problems of aging, and we would continue more as machines. So at the time, I think it was 2000, I thought, if I could download a consciousness into a machine, what form would it take? So I ended up making this young girl who was a cutout of myself as about an 8-year-old when I thought, from a photo, having her go on a robotic platform, move on a robotic platform, and then treating the video that was captured, some was saved, some was only played back, much like our memory works. And it was, to me, about, if you look at this machine-like interpretation of what a human being is, where does, you know, all the things about being human, like consciousness and emotion, although that's become changed over time, where would that, what would happen to that? So that's a question I was asking in that work.
Your works often take the viewer into known and unknown territory. For example, what happens when one enters Imaginal Expression's perceptual world? And what does this ask of the imagination?
It's really hard for me to speak about what the viewer sees, because they bring their own experience to something. I can tell you how I experienced it when I put it together the first time. You imagine what something's going to look like, but I never had the four projectors till I actually made the work and was showing in the gallery. I had one or two. I could sort of see what it was going to look like. But to make something on that scale, I almost felt like I could fall into it and almost merge with it. But I can't answer what the viewer would. I mean, I get all kinds of responses to my work. I did a residency in a gallery, and school children looked at my work, and that piece in particular, and adults would look at that work. And I was just outside in an office where I was doing new work, and sometimes they would come in, and I would get people who understood fully what I was getting at and want to talk about evolution and protein molecules and how the world was changing. And then I would have somebody who would come in and say, and didn't say it to me, but raging past my office to the front desk saying, "This isn't art. How was this funded by public money?" You can't always tell how people react to your work.
Your latest works, Fragments, will be highlighted in an exhibition at the School of Art Gallery here at the University of Manitoba. When will it be?
I will be installing it, opening on February 6th, and in that exhibition will be three pieces from a total of five pieces that I made that dealt with drone technology. Drone is really a media word, and how they were impacting upon and the kinds of changes they were making in the world, and the militarization of them, and the transcending of boundaries to target people in countries you're not at war with. I mean, I did a ton of research on this. There are many, many, many ideas, and I ended up taking pieces of the things that I found the most intriguing. So I've done, two already have shown, and one had to do with countries in the world that own drones, and the ones that are militarized are, I made an animated video that did that pointed out which were militarized. You began to recognize, if you watch this for a while, who is actually selling them to what countries, because some are from China, some are from Switzerland, Israel, United States. So that was the first piece I did, and then I did another piece that replicated the underground. So in the exhibition, there's going to be three different pieces. One is going to be very large, and it's going to take up one of the walls in the gallery space, and I'm working on making an animation for that. But it has to do with the crowding of our skies, the fact that these machines are mechanical, and they're going to fall and break, and it's a variety. I'm still working on it, so it's a little hard to talk about it, but in some cases, they're going to fall out of the sky, and they're going to be 50 feet long. And sometimes they'll be teeny tiny things you see in the distance, different kinds of drones. So that's one piece. Another piece looks at two things, the connection between drones and the radio-controlled airplanes that filmed the atomic bomb. In both cases, there's going to be quotes that have to do with things that were said about the atomic bomb and the drone technology being used in a way there would not be a lot of collateral damage. So that's the second one. And the third one has to do with real quadcopters, two that are quite small, but they're going to be used as surveillance instruments in the exhibition space. And then they're video captured that they're able to observe and used to make a comment on the fact that they're used for surveillance, that drones are used for surveillance. So, yeah, they are a little creepy, some of them, but it's probably the most direct work that I've made. Most of my other work was a little more poetic on some level. I guess in my research, I got so upset in many ways with what I was reading and things that were released, you know, from in the U.S. that became public knowledge about mistaken surveillance of family that they thought were maybe terrorists. It turned out they were having a picnic, you know, things like that. And also the idea, people who are being targeted are being selected by computer algorithm. So in my piece, there's something happens to people selected by computer algorithm.
Moving on to being an artist in residence at the university this year, what do you enjoy most about that?
I'm actually enjoying it a lot. I'm meeting a lot of the students. They're really enthusiastic about what they're doing. And I've been asked to do more than just give an artist talk about my work. They want to know how to survive as an artist. They want to know what kind of steps to take after school and how to remain an artist. And so I'm sort of mentoring in a way, too. I mean, I have almost 35-year history of being an artist, so it's been really interesting. And I'm also critiquing. If a student wants me to come and talk to them about their work, I'm available. I'm more available here on the days I'm here than doing actual work on my own work.
What are your plans after?
After my residency? Well, I have to get ready for the exhibition. And I have some ideas niggling at the back of my mind for where to go next. And I have to think about it because sometimes I have a huge idea waiting in the wings. And right now I've just got little niggles. So we'll see what happens.
Well, I'd like to thank you very much for having me to your studio and being a guest on Art World Innovators tonight. It's been a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. It's been interesting to talk with you.
Thank you. That was Reva Stone, this year's Artist in Residence at the School of Art at the University of Manitoba.
I'm your host, Susan Cohn, and we thank you for listening to Art World Innovators here on UMFM 101.5 at the University of Manitoba. Join us again next Wednesday from 5:30 to 6 p.m. for more on today's innovators in the art world.